Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car looked in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to continuing coverage of the Rust Alex Baldwin movie shooting trial
from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Now, back to the courtroom.
You may be seated. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. The state calls Robert Gillette.
Do you have your...
Is it on the election? Go on up here. Step up here, face the judge, you're going to raise your hand.
Do you swear or affirm under penalty of law that the testimony you'll give in this case will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
All right, thank you. Have a seat. Talk into the microphone.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Great. Would you please state your name for the record?
My name is Robert Gillette. Last name spelled G-I-L-L-E-T-T-E.
And where are you currently employed?
I am employed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation within the Explosives Unit, which is part of the Laboratory Division.
And how long have you worked for the FBI?
I started with the FBI in 2009 as a contractor. I was hired on as an employee in 2012.
And what's your official title?
My official title is Chemist Forensic Examiner.
And how long have you been working as a chemist forensic examiner?
For about 11 years now.
All right. Can you give us a brief wrap-up of your educational background?
I have a Bachelor of Science and a Master of Science in Chemistry from George Mason University. It's in Fairfax, Virginia.
And do you have any training and experience in chemist forensic examination?
Specifically, to become a qualified chemist forensic examiner, I had to complete a training program. That training program started with supervised casework, so casework where supervised either chemists or chemistry examiners oversaw my actions. It included knowledge checks on the different types of instruments that I used, and then competency tests for all of the different procedures that we had. So,
go ahead.
After that, I had to successfully complete multiple oral boards of examinations in topics that covered explosives, the chemistry of explosives, as well as the different analytical techniques that we use in the laboratory. And then after that came two different moot court exercises that I had to successfully complete, as well as supervised case reporting. And then I was a qualified chemist forensic examiner.
Have you ever been recognized by a court as an expert in this field in the past?
Yes, I have.
Great. At this time, Your Honor, I'd move the court to recognize Mr. Gillette as an expert witness in the field of chemical forensic examination.
No objection.
All right, an expert in chemical forensic examination.
That's it. All right, Mr. Gillette, how did you become involved in this case?
For this case, I was asked to perform explosives chemistry examinations on what were suspected to be ammunition propellant samples.
And what sort of testing were you asked to perform?
Well, that was the explosives chemistry examinations.
Can you describe exactly what that testing is?
Yes, it starts with a visual examination, literally looking at what we have to determine where it's going to fit within the different procedures that we have for examining explosives or materials used to make explosives. After that visual examination, it'll point me towards a specific procedure, and in this case, they ended up being what's known as, or they appeared to be, what's called smokeless powders. It's a type of ammunition propellant. So we have a technical procedure specifically for that, and the first step is visual examination. So I continued my visual examination and used a microscope to look at the specific particles under a microscope, but also to take photographs and make measurements, because that's part of our examination. After the visual examination came what's called a solvent extraction, literally using a liquid to ideally extract out the components of those individual particles so that they could be analyzed. And then I analyzed that solvent, that liquid, using an instrument called a gas chromatograph coupled to a mass spectrometer. A chromatograph is an instrument that simply, or ideally, separates out a mixture into its individual components so that each individual component can be identified, detected and identified, and that's what the mass spectrometer does. And after that, those samples, after they had been extracted by the solvent, they were analyzed using a technique called Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy. And spectroscopy techniques, or spectroscopic techniques, are just techniques where you have a known amount of energy that interacts with a sample, and those interactions can give information as to the specific, either the elements contained within the sample, or how those elements are bound to one another to give molecular, so structural information. And then the last step is a technique called a thermal susceptibility test. That's literally taking a small amount of material, introducing heat in the form of flame, and then seeing how it reacts.
Thank you. Mr. Gillette, did you take any photographs as part of your examination in this case?
Yes, I took multiple photographs using one of our microscopes.
Great. Your Honor, may I approach the witness?
Yes.
Mr. Gillette, would you please look at these two photographs and tell me if these are photographs that you took as part of your laboratory testing?
Yes, I took both of the photographs.
Great. Your Honor, Mr. Bowles and I have stipulated to the admission of State's Exhibits 111A and 111B. May I move for entry of those and request to publish?
Yes.
Thank you.
I'll admit them. We'll publish.
All right. Mr. Gillette, let's start with this image. I'll zoom out a little bit. Are you able to see that on your monitor?
Not at the moment, no.
Okay. Let's fix that.
Oh, there it is.
All right. Mr. Gillette, did you take this photograph?
Yes, I did.
And what is this a photograph of?
This is a photograph of a handful of the particles from item 4.
All right. When you say item 4, can you explain what item 4 is?
Item 4 is one of the samples that I received with respect to this case.
What was the form of item 4?
What do you mean by form?
Was it a cartridge of live ammunition?
It was a disassembled cartridge. I don't recall specifically every single component within the container that contained item 4, but I was focused on the suspected ammunition propellant.
Great. And did you examine some other items that had a smokeless powder that looked just like this?
Yes, I did.
And what were those items?
Those would have been items 4 through 7, and there was a fifth one. I don't recall the item number.
Would it help you refresh your recollection if you look at your report?
Yes, it would.
Please take a look at your report.
Okay.
Do you now know what the fifth item was?
Yes, it was item 13-1.
All right. And do you know where these items were sourced from?
Specifically, I don't recall the sources for every single item, but it was either from a cart, a bandolier, a holster, and I believe a tray.
Okay. And all five of these items, they have this identical smokeless powder composition in them. Is that correct?
Well, they have this physical appearance.
Right.
And the shape and size and color.
Okay, great. Now I'd like to show you what has been marked as State's Exhibit 111B. What can you tell me about this photograph?
This is another photograph I took using a microscope. This is item 24-1.
All right, and what does this picture show?
The appearance and the physical characteristics, what we call the morphology, the shape, size, color of this specific powder.
And did you examine more than one item that had this type of powder?
Yes, I did. There were six that had this morphology.
And do you know what the source of those six items was?
The source?
Where they were found?
I recall in one of the laboratory examination requests that received, the source wasn't specifically a location for two of them. It was a name, and then the others had a street address in Albuquerque.
Do you recall what the name was?
I believe the name was Seth Kenny.
And do you recall the address?
The specific address? No, I think it was Monroe Street in Albuquerque.
Okay, great. What I'd like to do now, and before I do this, all six of the cartridges that you, or the disassembled cartridges, that were either identified from as coming from Seth Kinney or from the Monroe Street address have smokeless powder that looks like this. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
All right. Now I'd like to put these kind of side to side. And if you can, I know that it's kind of obvious, but could you explain to the jurors kind of what some of the visual differences between these two different types of smokeless powders are?
They both have generically the same shape. We would call that disc-shaped. However, the ones on the left are slightly smaller and they're darker in color. The ones on the right are slightly larger and have a single perforation.
Great. Aside from their visual appearance, did you conduct any testing to see if they were different chemically?
Yes, I conducted the explosives chemistry examinations that identified them both as smokeless powders but with different chemical constituents.
And for those on the left, what were your conclusions?
The items on the left were identified as a double base smokeless powder.
And for the right?
A single base smokeless powder. They were both disc-shaped, but the ones on the right were, obviously, they had the single perforation.
All right. And what sort of conclusions are you able to draw from both the visual analysis and your chemical analysis between these two different types of smokeless powders?
Between the two, they are both physically and chemically different from one another.
All right. Is it fair to say that these probably came from two different manufacturers?
Oh, I couldn't say that because one manufacturer might make a whole bunch of different types of smokeless powder.
Sure, understandable. All right, I'll pass the witness.
Cross-exam.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gillette.
Good afternoon.
So, the number of items you tested in this case, that was 11 different items, right?
Correct.
Okay. And these items that you tested were all cartridges that were given to you by Santa Fe, by law enforcement, right?
No, specifically, I didn't test any cartridges. It was the suspected ammunition propellant.
But you received cartridges?
I received, yes, I did.
And your role in this was not to make sure that... like, I guess what I'm trying to say is you had no role in selecting which cartridges or which powders you were going to test, right? You tested what they gave you.
Correct.
And you received, is it true, it's the form you received them in, It was 11 Ziploc bags, right?
Yes, I believe they were Ziploc style bags.
And each of the bags had a bullet, a casing, and a screw top container with some powder in it. Is that right?
I believe that's what it was.
So then when you received these items, these cartridges, they weren't intact.
That is correct. They were not intact.
The powder was already removed out.
That is correct.
And do you know who removed the powder out?
No, I do not.
Okay. Now, FBI Laboratory, that's where you said you worked on direct. Are you aware of a Mr. Ziegler that works in FBI Laboratory as well?
Yes, Bryce Ziegler was the assigned examiner in the Firearms and Toolmarks Unit.
Okay. And was he the one who had these items prior to you testing them?
I believe so, yes.
And you don't know if Mr. Ziegler is the one that removed the powder or if somebody else removed the powder?
I'm not certain that it was Mr. Ziegler. I would assume that it was him.
Okay. So you can't say if the powder from these cartridges was all of it there or if it was just part of the powder from the cartridges, if it was just a sampling. You don't have no way of knowing that, right?
No, I do not.
So you don't know if the powder actually came, in addition, you don't know if the powder actually came from the particular cartridge that it was in parts in the Ziploc either. It could have come from a different one.
Well, since I didn't disassemble them specifically, no, I can't say that where they specifically came from.
Right. And your testing, you talked about the source of the 11 items you got. Being part of them from an individual named Seth Kinney, right?
Correct, yes.
Hey.
I should say that's what was on one of the communications that we got.
It's also on your report, right? Or is it not on your report?
I don't recall it being on the report. Okay.
Do you have any idea where Seth Kinney got these rounds from?
No.
Do you know how it is that Seth Kinney selected these specific rounds to provide to law enforcement to provide to you?
I don't know that he even provided them to law enforcement.
You just know they came from him, right?
I just know that in the one of the incoming communications we had, his name was stated as the either the source or where it was collected.
Okay. What about the timing? Do you know when these rounds that indicate they come from Seth Kinney? Do you know when those rounds came from Seth Kinney? If it was a month after the shooting, a day, 2 months, do you have any idea?
There would have been a date associated with that laboratory examination request, that incoming communication, so I could maybe assume around a specific time, but specifically no.
Okay, well, your report was dated May 3rd, 2012, right?
2022. Yeah.
May 3rd, 2022.
That sounds correct.
Okay. And Mr. Ziegler or somebody else had already disassembled these items before you got them, right? So you know.
Yes, they were disassembled before I got them.
So did you review Mr. Ziegler's report to determine when they were submitted to him?
No, I did not.
But you would have received these items after Mr. Ziegler then, right?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. Isn't it true that you're not actually able to tell us whether two powders that you receive are from different, if the two powders from different locations actually originated from the same source?
What do you mean by source?
Like if they're from the same source of a cartridge.
No, I couldn't specifically. I can just say what I received and what my examination results were.
Well, but you can't say that they originated from the same source. You can only say that they're consistent, right?
If I was performing if I was trying to associate two things together, like comparing two things together, but in this case, the two powders within this submission, they were physically and chemically distinct from one another. So they wouldn't be able to be from the same source.
Well, but you, right, well, but you have a way to, You can only say that they're consistent. You can't say that they are from the same source.
Oh, if say that these two powders were not different, both physically and chemically, the best I could say then was that they are physically and chemically consistent with one another, if that were even the case, which is not the way it is.
Now, I've seen, so it appears that there were several cartridges that were sent to the FBI laboratory for testing beyond the 11. And I just want to make sure you don't have an additional report, or you didn't test any of the other cartridges that went to the FBI lab other than these 11?
That's correct. I was only given 11 samples to examine.
And so it seems like the purpose of your work is to determine whether there's smokeless powder present, right?
Well, I would say the purpose is to determine whether or not the suspected ammunition propellant is ammunition propellant.
And that would be one type of ammunition propellant is smokeless powder that you're looking for, right?
Correct.
Okay. And you used, in order to do that, you used this whole scientific process you just talked about on direct to determine whether these were live rounds, right? You actually had to look at the chemical composition of the powder in order to tell the difference, right?
No, I never made a determination as to whether or not something was a live round. From my explosives chemistry examinations, I determined whether or not they were explosives, specifically ammunition propellant, specifically smokeless powder.
Right, but in order to do that, you actually had to do a chemical composition of the powder to tell the difference, right?
Correct.
And the technique that you had to do to do that is, and you were trying to tell if this it was, I think you said, what, visual microscopic inspection first, right?
Correct.
And then you also did a thermal susceptibility test.
Correct.
And then infrared, like
spectroscopy.
But the spectroscopic techniques.
Correct.
Is that what? Okay. And then there was one more. It was the gas chromatography. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. So that sounds very scientific here. These tests are all done in a laboratory, right?
Correct.
And in order, and that is the way that you determine if this powder is in fact an ammunition propellant. Is this all scientific, in the lab kind of stuff?
Correct, by following the specific technical procedure that we have.
And your procedure also produced over 100 pages of notes, didn't it?
Not specifically notes, I would say case notes. They were probably shorter than that, maybe a dozen or so, but all of the instrument data, definitely over 100 pages.
All right, I'm gonna switch gears a little bit to, you were asked some questions about the manufacturer. Isn't it true that it's actually possible to determine the brand of a powder?
If there's enough identifying physical and chemical characteristics, it potentially could be possible, yes.
Okay, and that's something that you are able to perform, but you weren't asked to do that in this case?
No, we weren't asked to do that.
In fact, does the FBI have a standard operating procedure for smokeless powder analysis that discusses brand determination?
Not specifically brand determination, but trying to find a specific type of smokeless powder, yes.
Are you saying there's no FBI SOP that talks brand determination?
I don't recall specifically brand determination being in it, but maybe it is. But there are ways, and we do even have a database of several hundred different smokeless powders, but that we could compare results to. But we weren't asked to do that, and sort of as you alluded to, it's very, very hard to say that two things are the same. Technically, it would be very, very hard for us to say these two powders are these. A specific type of brand, but if there were enough physical and chemical distinct characteristics within them that we could hopefully at best narrow it down to a brand and maybe like a line of products.
Right, and in fact what you just said with the FBI's laboratory having a database with smokeless powders that can assist in brand name determination, that's in the SOP, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. But you weren't asked to go through that database in this case or to do that?
No, there was no request to try to determine the specific manufacturer.
Okay. So let's talk about, I think you also took some measurements, right, of the diameter of the particles?
Correct.
And the purpose of that, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's you can, in taking the diameter, you can compare the similarities and differences of the diameters, right?
Yes.
That's a purpose. But in this case, you weren't asked to perform an associations analysis?
Oh, we don't have an associations analysis.
Okay.
But I did differentiate between the two different types of powders that were identified.
Right, but in terms of actually comparing them, let's talk about the weighing. The you didn't weigh the powder, right?
No, I did not.
Okay, and that would be another way, would you agree, to differentiate the different particles by weighing it?
But by how one specific particle weighs?
Right.
Yes.
And so you don't know from, because you didn't weigh them, I guess, if these were partially full or completely full, the cartridges, when the powder was in them.
Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't do any sort of weight examination, no.
But wouldn't weight tell you, weighing the powder would tell you how much was in the cartridge, right?
Yes, in terms of weight, yes.
Now, I think we were talking a little bit about timeline earlier. I think you said that your work in this case, your report was dated in May of 2022, but your work is actually done in like April of 2022. Is that right?
Correct. I believe I started in April of 2022.
And how soon would you start? And I mean, you can tell me, can you extrapolate from that? If you started your work in April, did your report in May, when these items were received by you?
By me, I would have to look at the chain of custody.
Okay. Would it be close to April of 2022?
I would expect it to be April of 2022.
Okay. So you weren't provided with these until April of 2022?
I would have to look at the chain of custody to be certain, but I believe I received them in April of 2022.
All right. And I mean, you said you're the chemist. You did all the tests here, but you have no personal knowledge about where these were on October 21st of 2021, right?
Correct.
Just a second.
Pass the witness.
Redirect.
Mr. Gillette, does the FBI and your lab in particular have procedures and policies in place that discuss cross-contamination of evidence?
Objection, you're outside the scope.
She asked him.
I never asked about cross-contamination.
Overruled.
Go ahead and answer.
Yes, we do.
Can you describe those policies and procedures to the jury, please?
Specifically within the explosives unit, we minimize, reduce, and eliminate cross-contamination a number of different ways. When we start our examinations, wherever we're working, we don clean PPE, so lab coat, gloves, safety glasses. But we have to clean our work surface typically with isopropanol, so rubbing alcohol, and then put down clean butcher paper so that the surface we're working on is clean and not contaminated, and that we anytime we handle a different sample, we either do that, change our gloves, just, you know, those sort of procedures to make sure we're not introducing anything into the sample that isn't part of the sample.
Do you ever work on two samples at the same time?
Yes.
In what circumstances would you work on two samples at the same time?
Or I can contain them and keep them separated from one another.
Okay. Nothing further.
All right, you're excused. Thank you, sir. Next witness.
Your Honor, the state calls Jerry Lynn Conway.
Can you get approach?
Yeah. The law that the testimony you'll give in this case will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
All right, thank you. Have a seat, talking to the microphone.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Great. Would you please state your name for the record?
Yes, my name is Gerilyn Conway. It's spelled Gerilyn Conway.
And what's your current occupation?
I'm a DNA examiner in the DNA casework unit at the FBI laboratory.
And what are some of your responsibilities as a DNA examiner?
As an examiner, I basically manage a case. When a case comes to our unit for DNA testing, I determine what testing we're going to do on those items of evidence, and then a team of biologists will do the testing for that case. I'll review the results of that test. I'll determine if more tests need to be conducted, and then I'll do comparisons and write a report, and then testify as needed.
Great. Tell us about your educational background.
I have a Bachelor's of Science in Genetics from Texas A&M University and a Master's of Science in Molecular Biology from New Mexico State University.
And prior to working at the FBI, what kind of experience did you have?
I worked in a genetics lab at New Mexico State University working on cotton genetics testing.
Great. And you may have already said, I missed it, how long have you been working at the FBI?
I've been there since 2000, so almost 24 years.
Great. And have you attended any specialized training for the position you currently hold at the FBI?
I did. I went through about a two-year training program. I took moot court examinations so that I could be sure to be able to explain my results to a group of jurors. And then I also took oral board examinations in the fields of serology, genetics, and statistics.
Great. And have you ever been recognized by a court previously as an expert witness in this field?
I have, yes.
Great. Your Honor, I move that the court recognize Ms. Conway as an expert witness in the field of forensic serology and DNA analysis.
Bless you, Your Honor. No objection.
All right.
All right.
I'm so admitted, I don't want to have to repeat that when I sneezed and couldn't hear some of it. All right.
Forensic serology and DNA analysis.
Thank you, admitted.
All right, thank you. What is forensic serology?
Forensic serology is the identification of body fluids, such as blood, on items of evidence.
And how do you perform serological examination on items of evidence?
When a biologist looks at an item of evidence, they'll look for areas of staining. So those areas of staining then will be tested with chemicals. A small portion of that stain will be swabbed using a swab is like a Q-tip with just the cotton on one end. That moistened Q-tip will be used to sample a small portion of that stain. And then chemicals will be added to that swab and a color change will be expected. If it's positive, that means that blood might be present on that item. It's considered a presumptive test. And if it's negative, then blood was not detected on that item.
Great. And can you give us just a general description of what exactly is DNA?
DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid, and it acts as our genetic blueprint. We inherit our DNA from our parents. We get half from our mother and half from our father, and we basically have two copies of our DNA.
And where is DNA found?
DNA is found in our cells, and our cells are the building blocks of our bodies. And if you think of a cell like an egg, then the yolk of the egg, we call that the nucleus. And the nuclear DNA is what we test in our forensic testing.
And how can DNA be used to differentiate between different individuals?
Most of our DNA is the same. However, there is a small portion that is different among us. Some of those portions are tested in our forensic testing, and those portions are called STRs, which stands for short tandem repeats. These repeats are pieces of DNA that are repeated over and over. When we do DNA testing, we determine how many repeats an individual has in their DNA, and then we're able to look at those areas that differ among individuals.
Can you describe for the jury what's the procedure that you use to develop a DNA type?
The procedure goes through a step-by-step process in the laboratory. And when the biologist sees that there is a stain to be tested, then they can either cut that stain or they might use another swab to swab a portion of that stain. That stain or that swab will be cut and put into a tube that's barcoded and then moves through the rest of the process. After it's collected, then it's extracted, and extraction just means that the DNA is purified away from the rest of the material, so the material it was collected on, and then any other cellular material that might be present. The next step is quantitation, where a portion of that sample is put into an instrument to determine how much DNA is present in that sample, and then a portion of the sample is taken based on that quantitation to the next step, which is amplification. The amplification means that there are pieces, those pieces that we're interested in, those STRs, are amplified so that they can be detected in an instrument. So after the amplification is complete, then a small portion of that sample is moved onto an instrument to separate it out by size. After it's sized, then I can look at that resulting data and determine the DNA profile from that sample.
And what's a reference sample?
A reference sample is a sample from an individual, and we know whose DNA that is. So it goes through all of the same processes to get a DNA profile at the end. But in this case, I know whose DNA is present in that sample, and I can use it for a comparison.
Great. And what does a DNA profile look like?
A DNA profile basically looks like peaks on a graph. So that instrument that separates it out by size, when those pieces move through that instrument, then they are recorded by the instrument, and then I can look at that data. Basically, we look at 21 different locations to determine a person's DNA profile. Those 21 different locations have results at those locations, which end up just being numbers. And remember, we get half of our DNA from mom and half from dad, which means that at any given location, a person might have one result, which means they got the same number of repeats from mom and dad, or they have two results, so they get two different numbers of repeats from mom and dad.
And what is a mixed profile?
So a mixed DNA profile means that more than one person's DNA is detected on the sample that has been analyzed. And I can tell that it's a mixture when I see more than two results at any of those locations that I test.
So after you develop a profile, what's your next step in terms of how do you do your comparison?
So my next step is to look at the DNA types from the reference sample, from someone whose DNA I know it came from, and compare that to the sample that I got from the evidence. When I do that comparison, I might have enough information that I can exclude that person outright. If I can, then I will do that. If not, then I'll use a statistical program to assess how common or rare the DNA types are in the sample, and also, could this person be a contributor to that DNA profile?
So aside from that, what other conclusions can you draw from a comparison?
So once I've used my statistical analysis, I have a result that's called a likelihood ratio. This likelihood ratio is basically a comparison of two different explanations for the DNA evidence. One explanation is that the person who I'm comparing to is a contributor to that profile. And the other explanation is that person is not a contributor, and rather an unknown, unrelated person is a contributor to that evidence.
How do you calculate the significance of a match?
That likelihood ratio gives me a number, and that number, the higher it is, the more support I have for one of those explanations over the other. So remember, if the likelihood ratio is high, then the explanation that that person is a contributor is more supported than the explanation that that person is not a contributor.
And do you do any sort of ongoing testing to make sure that your results are reliable?
I know that my results are reliable because our laboratory goes through there's a number of quality assurance procedures that are in place at the laboratory. We use controls to ensure that the results, we use a positive control to show that our tests are working and we get an expected result from a positive control. And then we also use negative controls to ensure that we have no contamination in our reagents or chemicals that we use. We also, our biologists are highly trained. they're qualified to do the work, and they also wear personal protective equipment. They wear lab coats, they wear gloves, they wear masks and goggles to ensure that they don't contaminate the evidence they're working on either.
Thank you. Ms. Conway, how did you become involved in this case?
So this case was submitted to the DNA casework unit, and it was, and then I determined that the samples in this case needed to go through testing, and that testing was then conducted by the biologist. Following that testing, I then reviewed those results and wrote the report.
And exactly what sort of testing were you asked to perform?
We did both serology and DNA testing in this case.
All right. And what was the item that you tested?
We tested a revolver.
All right. I'm going to show you what's been previously marked as State's Exhibit 9. Is your monitor on over there?
It is.
All right. Does this appear to be a photograph of the revolver that you performed your testing on?
It does.
Okay. Great. Was your lab able to detect and obtain a usable DNA reference sample from this revolver?
We obtained a profile from a sample that was taken from the revolver, yes.
Okay. And did you have comparators to check the reference sample against?
We compared this to four reference samples that were submitted in this case.
And do you know who those four are?
Yes, I do. We got a reference sample from Alexander Baldwin, a reference sample from Hannah Gutierrez, a reference sample from David Halls, and a reference sample from Sarah Zachary.
And what were the results of your comparisons? Were you able to include or exclude any of these reference individuals?
Yes. For each of those individuals, I developed a likelihood ratio, and the likelihood ratio is different for each person. So the likelihood ratio for Mr. Baldwin, the DNA results from the sample from the revolver are 110,000 times more likely if Mr. Baldwin and two unknown unrelated individuals are contributors to that sample rather than if three unknown unrelated individuals are contributors to that sample.
And with regard to Ms. Gutierrez, what were your findings?
With regard to Ms. Gutierrez, the DNA results from that sample from the revolver are equally likely if Ms. Gutierrez and two unknown unrelated individuals are contributors to that sample rather than if three unknown unrelated individuals are contributors to that sample. This means that the DNA analysis was, the likelihood ratio was one, and that DNA analysis was uninformative.
Okay. So is it fair to say you can't say for sure whether Ms. Gutierrez handled this gun?
I can't say for sure whether her DNA was detected in the sample that I analyzed.
Okay, thank you. That's fair. I want to change gears a little bit, and I want to talk to you now about the DNA testing of cartridge casings. What can you tell the jury about the FBI policy of testing cartridge casings?
The policy at the FBI is to not conduct DNA testing on cartridge casings.
And why is that?
There's a limited chance that DNA would be obtained from those cartridge casings, especially if they have been fired. The heat from firing a weapon is significant enough that DNA can be very degraded and broken down from that heat.
And is the policy the same even if the cartridge hasn't been fired?
That's right. It's not our policy to test cartridge casings.
Okay. So if the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office had sent you some casings to test, what would you have done with those?
We would not have tested them.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I'll pass the witness.
Cross-exam.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ma'am, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So are you saying that the FBI policy is never to test cartridges for DNA?
Our general policy is to not test them. That's right.
Our general policy. So does that mean it ever happens?
I believe it has happened in some cases, but our policy is to not accept those cases.
Okay. Well, for example, a terrorism case comes through. Very important, right? Terrorism case is presented to you. They say, we need you to test cartridges for DNA. Has something like that ever happened at the FBI?
I'm not aware specifically of a case where they have been tested.
Okay. But you are aware that the FBI can do that. They have the capability to test cartridges for DNA.
It's possible to test them, yes, but there's a number of reasons that we do not, and our case acceptance is to not test them.
Okay, and the allocation of resources, whatever that may be, but you can do that as a unit, as the FBI. You're not telling the jury the FBI can't test rounds for DNA, are you?
Testing for DNA requires that a sample in our lab would be swabbed, and that would also destroy any latent fingerprints that might be present. And so our policy is to leave those samples for latent fingerprints.
Okay, so you would prefer latent fingerprints be collected from those?
Perhaps.
Okay. Now, in this case, you received four DNA buccal swabs.
I did.
And a buccal swab for the jury, is that inside your...
It's a cheek swab from the inside of your cheek.
Okay, and that gets the DNA that you can use later for the comparison.
That's right.
Okay. Now, you did not receive Seth Kenny buccal swab, did you?
I did not.
Okay. And you did not receive anybody else other than those four individuals?
That's correct.
And so your primary conclusion in this case was that Baldwin likely touched the revolver, correct?
My primary conclusion is that the DNA that I tested supports the inclusion of Mr. Baldwin as a contributor to that DNA, yes.
Okay. And the other part I didn't quite understand, the three unknown contributors, but the bottom line is the likelihood he touched it. Obviously, he said he did.
His DNA is consistent with the DNA that I found on the gun, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Nothing further.
All right. Thank you. You're excused.
Thank you. Your Honor, can we approach?
Okay? Sure. Yeah. We're going to take a 5-minute break on conferring. I think it's easier if you just stay here instead of transported back and forth, but certainly stand, stretch, drink some water. We're not going to stand for you, though, for now. Affirm under penalty of law that the testimony you'll give in this case will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do, Your Honor.
All right, have a seat, talking to the microphone.
Go ahead and state your name for the record, please.
Ross Adiego.
Spell your last name, if you would.
Addiego.
Mr. Adiego, how are you currently employed?
As a dolly grip.
Can you explain to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury what a dolly grip does?
I help the camera department in any way possible with camera support. So any camera movement, whether on a dolly, camera cranes, rigging a camera to vehicles, I assist them in any way that I can as a representative from the grip department.
You do this on movie sets?
Movie sets, television sets, music videos, commercials, yes.
Give us a little bit of an idea of your background and experience in the film industry. How long have you been working as a dolly grip or generally kind of as camera supportive crew?
I've been in the industry almost 30 years at this point.
And when we talk about film credits, tell the ladies and gentlemen of the jury what we mean when we say film credits.
On a TV show, we wouldn't often be listed at the end of the show. On a movie, you would see credits roll at the end of a movie. But online, there's a database, internet movie database, that kind of tracks not only the productions, the shows, the actors, and also the crew, which I would fall under. So that essentially acts as a resume for me.
And on that online database, approximately how many film credits do you have?
Over 100.
And would you say that over 100 is approximately the number of film credits that you really have?
I would say that represents half of my time on set. Certain things don't get, a lot of commercials don't get listed, music videos don't get listed. Most of my TV and film work, I think, is on there.
Okay. So your total amount of credits might be closer to 200?
That's probably a safe assessment, yes.
Okay. And back in October of 2021, how were you employed?
I was employed as the A-camera dolly grip on a little movie called Rust.
So when you say A-camera, is there more than one camera?
Yes, that movie had two cameras, an A-camera and a B-camera.
And is that common?
It is very much common, yes.
Have you ever worked on films that had more than two cameras?
Yes.
And have you worked on films that had only one camera?
Yes.
So as the A-camera dolly grip, can you just kind of walk us through what you're doing on set?
In the simplest terms, helping the director of photography capture the director and writer's vision for the project.
And specifically, how are you doing that? Physically, what are you doing?
Again, assisting with the camera movement. On this movie, we had a good number of crane shots, so high and wide, to see the western town or the beautiful environment we were in. A lot of dolly moves, so there was constantly movement throughout the story, whether moving into a set or coming out of a set to reveal other characters.
So what's the dolly, and what is the dolly used for?
The dolly is a piece of camera support equipment used in lieu of a tripod or another stable or static camera support apparatus. So the dolly typically has eight wheels, different size dollies depending on the project, and it also has a hydraulic boom system, so I can, with my controls, boom the camera up and down, whether during the shot or to set up a shot and get the camera where both the director of photography and the camera operator and the director think it best tells the story we're trying to tell in that moment.
And who was the director of photography for this film?
Helena Hutchins.
And who was the director for this film?
Joel Souza.
And do you recall, was the camera operator for camera A always the same person?
Until the fateful day, it was the same person.
And who was that person?
His name was Andy. His last name escapes me at this moment.
Okay. In this film, was camera A always on a dolly?
No.
So other than the camera filming from the dolly, how else can cameras film?
We did a good bit of handheld. So my cameraman would have the camera on his shoulder by his hip, and I would assist him with that weight and keeping him safe as he's moving around.
And let me stop you right there.
Yes.
Approximately how much does that camera weigh?
On that project, it was, depending on the lens, 40-ish pounds.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
And then we also had Andy on a man-rideable crane, which means that I could put him on a camera crane that was 20-some-odd feet long or longer and kind of put him up in the air to get wide vistas of our sets and locations.
So how long had filming been going on the set of Rust prior to October 21st?
We were a couple of weeks into it.
And when you say a couple of weeks, are we talking, how many days are in the work week?
My recollection is we were doing 5-day weeks, but at some point our weeks shifted. I think we were doing a Tuesday through Saturday schedule, so we were 10 to 12 days in, I believe, at that point.
Okay, 10 to 12 days of actual filming.
Correct.
Okay, because you had weekends.
We did. We typically had whatever our union protocol was, 2 days off, 48 okay. hours or some such.
Now, with regard to all of your film credits, can you tell the jury approximately how many projects you've worked on where there was an armorer on the crew?
Can't give you an exact number, but a dozen or more at this point in my career.
And why would a production company hire an armorer?
Because they plan to use potentially deadly weapons and ammunition.
And what is your understanding of what the responsibilities of a set armorer are?
Your Honor, I'm going to object. Can we approach on this?
Sure. Mr. Odiego, based on your experience working on films with armorers, do you know what the armorer is responsible for?
Yes.
Can you tell us?
My understanding of the armorer's responsibilities is any working firearms and any ammunition is under their control.
And when you say that working firearms and ammunition are under your control, are under their control, let me ask you, in your experience, are there certain industry protocols that are followed on movie sets by armorers?
Yes.
Your Honor, I'm going to object again to lack of foundation.
I'm going to sustain that objection.
You've testified that you have worked on 12 movie sets with armorers. Is that correct?
It is correct.
12 or more?
At least 12.
Has that experience made you familiar with what you believe are the industry protocols for armorers on movie sets?
Gunner, get on object.
Counsel approach.
Mr. Odiego, in the films that you worked on where there was an armorer, and for the purposes of this question, we're excluding the movie Rust, did you notice certain safety protocols that you yourself saw armorers engage in all of those movies up until you got to the movie Rust?
Yes.
So I'd like to talk to you about those. In the other movies where there were armorers that you worked on, can you describe for the ladies and gentlemen of the jury how, under what circumstances, in your experience, can you describe the safety protocols that the armorers on those other movies engaged in when they would bring a firearm onto set for use in filming a scene?
Your Honor, I'm also going to object to relevance. What happened on other movies has no relevance to what happened on Rust.
Response.
Can we approach?
Sure.
More Raw Courtroom audio from the Rust Alex Baldwin movie shooting trial is on the way.
Press subscribe so you don't miss a moment.
From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better. With new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect, the fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.